The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free Arfcom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free Arfcom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free Arfcom starts now.
Hello and welcome all my fellow ARFcomers. We got yet another great show for you lined up tonight on Radio Free ARFcom. I am your host, John Gold. And let me just go over tonight's show with you real quick. We're going to open up with our usual Joe DeBurgley from NRA. He's got a special guest that's going to be on with us. Then we're going to go to Sylvia Longmire. She runs a blog called Border Violence Analysis. It talks all about the violence, the cartel, Gulf cartel violence that's going on down on the border between the United States and Mexico. And she brings a really interesting insight to some of the things going on down there. We've got a get-to-know segment for you. We've got Mike Vanderbo coming on from Sipsy Street Irregulars. That's his blog. For those of you that don't know about him, please check out that blog. It's very, very interesting, to say the least. We're also going to have Dylan Jennings come on from DPMS Firearms. He's going to talk about the Outbreak Omega-3 shoot that they're going to have in April.
Okay, that was an auspicious start to the show right there. But we're on with Joe DeBurgley and Graham Hill. Joe, why don't you give Graham an introduction?
Surely. It's my honor to introduce to our ARFcom listeners a dear friend of mine, Graham Hill, who is currently running for the NRA Board of Directors. He's a personal hero of mine, a longtime friend, and a true advocate of the Second Amendment as well as the Black Rifle Platform. He's got extensive experience up on Capitol Hill, and he's a true sportsman in every sense of the word. With that, I introduce my good friend, Graham Hill.
Thank you, Joe. John, thank you for letting me come on the show with my good friend, Joe. I appreciate it very much, the opportunity to visit with the listeners.
Absolutely, and we're happy to have you on. I want to remind everybody out there who is an NRA voting member, the election is still going on to the end of this month. Is that correct?
I think the ballots need to be received at the NRA.
When was that by?
May have lost him, John. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. We're having some serious technical difficulties today, but that's fine. Do you know when the ballots need to be received by, Joe?
Yes, John. April 25th. They need to be postmarked, so we have to make sure we factor in a couple days there for delivery. So if everybody would make it a point to go to their March editions of the NRA magazines, that's where you'll find the ballot, and then read through the biographies. And I personally, we've talked about it in weeks past as a variety of ARFcom endorsed candidates, and Graham Hill is one of the people we want to forward his name as well.
Okay, we definitely want to get Graham on. I'm right now currently uploading his picture to the discussion thread for this week's show. It's a very interesting picture he's got. I think he's, let me see if I can
see. Can you all still hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, there you are.
Okay, good. That photo that you're uploading there is of me about 2 weeks ago on an annual quail hunt, and one of our friends brought his fully automatic MP40, a German machine gun manufactured in about 1944. I'd never shot one of these things before, and it's quite a piece of equipment, particularly his, because the wooden forestock is not attached to his, so you have the joy of holding the barrel while you shoot it, which means you can't shoot it for very long.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to
It's a tremendous, tremendous gun. It's got some shrapnel marks, and so it looks like it was in actual action in World War II.
How did you get started? How did you actually get started in shooting and firearms?
Well, I had the good fortune of growing up in a rural area of South Texas. My father and his father, and going back a long way, were all outdoorsmen and hunters and gun owners. So I came to this world from a very natural background where owning a firearm, hunting and shooting, carrying a pistol for protection was, from my point of view, normal, natural, and what most people did. My father always carried a pistol in the car, and whenever we were out on the ranches, he would wear it. And so later in life, as I left Texas and lived in different places in the country, it became very apparent that not everybody has that perspective on how natural and appropriate it is to own guns and use them for hunting and self-defense. So over my life, since I was very small, I got my first rifle when I was 6 years old. My mom almost killed my dad for giving me a rifle at that age. But he showed me how to use it, and we hunted together. And he taught me how to shoot shotgun sports and rifle and pistol. And it's a very core part of who I am as a person. And my relationships with many friends and with my extended family all revolve around hunting and firearms. So the idea that somebody who has a different perspective on a firearm would look at that lifestyle, that role of a firearm in your sense of yourself or your culture is something that's bad. It's just something that I know a lot of folks on this call and both of you find really terrible and something we have to fight judiciously every step of the way.
I'm glad you feel that way. That's a really interesting story about how you got started shooting with your dad, always carrying a sidearm with him and everything. What are your thoughts and feelings? I think I already know this, seeing you shoot the full-auto MP40 there. What are your thoughts and feelings on assault rifles, on the current restrictions for machine guns that we have, and just your basic idea for the AR-15 platform?
Well, I own an AR-15 A3 Colt. I use it both for hunting in Texas, so where I still do a lot of my hunting. I'm fortunate to have a place down there with some friends where we actually use those platforms in our hunting down there, mostly for feral hogs, which for those of you listening or from Texas or anywhere in the South where you've got feral hogs, know that they're just an absolute menace. So that's what I use hunting. And now we also shoot them down there at targets. We've got a PS-90 that we take down, an FN platform, very high velocity, low weight round that we also shoot down there. But I think it's an appropriate firearm for hunting. Different circumstances make it even better than a bolt-action rifle. We have bolt-action rifles that we use down there, too, but when you're hunting hogs, getting a lot of shots off at a herd of them is very important.
I've never been on a hog hunt. I've always wanted to. I watch some of the videos online of people hog hunting. I'm just like, oh, man, that just looks like so
I've
much
seen
fun.
Those, too. There's one fellow down there with a helicopter that they fly out of. I've never done anything like that. The most dangerous I've done is riding a truck. But they're fast-moving, and they are propagating at a really alarming rate. And it's an absolutely perfect match for AR-15 A3. I've got a Trigicon scope mounted on the top, which makes it a little bit unwieldy and bulky, but it shoots terrifically and is perfect for the job. Go ahead.
Now, how did you decide to get involved? Just so everybody knows, we're on with Graham Hill. He's running for an NRA board member spot. He's not on the actual list of ARFCOM-approved candidates, but he's one that both Joe DeBurglace and myself feel that would be very beneficial to us, ARFCOMers, lovers of the AR-15 platform. How did you decide to get involved with the NRA? What was the impetus for that?
Well, I've been a member for some time, and years ago I started working more and more here as I left Texas and moved to Virginia, and was in proximity to a lot of the staff and the other members of the board that are here in this area working on different committees of the NRA, in particular the Disabled Shooters with Disability Committee. In fact, when John Siegler, one of the past presidents of the NRA, set up a special advisory committee on disabled shooting, he made a good friend of Joe and yours and mine, Tom King, the chairman of it, and made me vice chairman of it. In fact, about 2 years ago, or a year ago, I guess, the NRA board officially made that a standing committee of the NRA. My work and interest in those activities flow in large part because I'm myself disabled, had a car accident about 28 years ago down in Texas. And as a result of my growing up outdoors and shooting and then being disabled, it was a natural overlap between the two. I've also served on the committee there at NRA, sports shooting committee, that's trying to increase the number of shooters that are coming to our sport, not just in competition terms, but also more recreational use as well. As you all know, the number of folks that relative to the overall population that are gun owners and hunters has been declining over the last few years, and we're trying to reverse that. The inspiration for this was a concern that unless people that care about this personally stand up and devote their time and their energy and their resources to working with the NRA, we are in a defensive position. We're going to be responding to what the antis want, and that's what got us in trouble back in the early 90s. We've got to all the time be vigilant, and we rely on individuals stepping up that have the time and energy and devotion to do it. And so I think that's a fair characterization of what got me to devote time and energy to these efforts and why I want to continue to do it. Having worked here in Washington for almost 20 years and while observing the processes of Washington, I can tell you that the people that don't stand and defend their rights on a daily basis are the ones that lose them.
I think we saw a great example of that yesterday.
Some of the thought that's running through Washington today is something that we've got to keep a very close eye on, certainly for the next 2 years in particular.
Absolutely. Tell me, you're in Washington, you've got your ear to the ground there. Have you heard any rumblings, any mumblings about any gun control legislation being prepared? Even if, I know nothing's been introduced, and I know the powers that be currently have really skirted around the issue because I think they know what type of powder keg type issue it is. Have you heard any rumblings about it?
Yeah, I think that last observation of yours at the moment is the conventional wisdom that at the moment this administration and the leadership on the Hill perceive messing around with Second Amendment issues as a lightning rod and are not going to do anything at the moment. Now, that basically means that they're waiting until they think there's an appropriate time or a better political environment. It's not that they don't want to make restrictions and other things real. They're just biding their time. The good news is that the most recent activity that I'm aware of up here has been things that have been positive. For example, the right to carry in national parks that took effect back in February, that's a recent issue. I think that passed the Congress sometime last year. That's expanded our ability to carry where it's where you can have a license in the state. I'm a concealed weapon permit holder, so I appreciate the fact that now in a national park in a state where I'm licensed to carry, I can carry there and not be violating federal law. I think the other thing that most folks here in D.C. are keeping an eye on is the waiting on the outcome of the McDonald versus Chicago Supreme Court case.
Yeah, we're all waiting on that.
That's obviously going to be a big deal. I'm very optimistic that the logic of the Heller decision will compel the court to apply this to the states, to the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that case because if the court does rule in gun owners' favor, which I think they will, it opens the doors for even more Second Amendment freedoms to be opened up for us. Isn't that correct?
I think it does. It's also going to mean that we're going to very likely have to keep a very close eye, and I know that the ILA and the state folks at NRA do this, but an eye on the states. It's while it's an individual right, and the individual right applies to the states, there's the possibility, like a lot of rights, that some kind of reasonable regulation of the right might also be conceivable. We'll have to see what the decision says, but I think it's an opportunity for all of us, and it may also come with some possible danger that we'll have to keep an eye on. I mean, we know that some cities and some states, particularly densely urban areas, have a warped perspective on the value and the meaning of Second Amendment rights, so we'll have to keep an eye on that.
We absolutely will. This is Graham Hill. He's on with us with Joe DeBurgley here to start the show. We're almost out of time. Graham Hill is running for an NRA board member spot. If you have not filled out your ballot yet, you are a voting member. Make sure you put your vote for him as well as for all the other AR15.com endorsed candidates. Graham Hill is pro Second Amendment all the way. He is pro assault rifle. He owns an AR-15. He just got done shooting a fully automatic MP40. And once I can figure out how to get this picture posted, I will get it up online of you shooting that gun. It's a really cool picture. Before we leave, is there anything you want to say to potential voters?
Well, I appreciate your consideration. Most of all, I want to make sure that you vote. Voting is how things work best in this country and how the NRA works best. There's a lot of good bios in there. Look at them all. And if to the extent you can give me your support, I appreciate it. I also want to praise you, John, for AR15.com and all that it does to help inform folks. You know, one of the big problems nowadays is information, what's accurate, what's really going on. There's so much information on the Internet, so many rumors. The job that you do and having folks like Joe on this show is really invaluable to keep people informed about what they really need to focus on, what's really going on, so they can ignore all the ambient noise and focus on where the attack really is.
Hey, I really appreciate all the work you do for gun owners and gun rights, Graham. And if for some reason you're not elected this time, why don't we get you back a couple of times during the year? We'll let our listeners get to know you a little bit better, and we'll make sure we get you elected next time if for some reason we can't get the job done this time. How does that sound?
I appreciate that very much, John. Then, by the way, this is the quietest I've ever heard Joe before. Is he even on the phone still?
Yeah, he's been silent this whole time. I can't believe it.
I was waiting for him to launch a sword at me, but he hadn't done it yet.
Well, you're waxing poetic there, so, Mr. Hill. I know you guys know out there why I hold him in such high esteem. He's truly one of us. He's educated. He's engaged in the process. And he will serve the board to the highest capacity that is possible. Now you guys know why he's my dear friend.
Thank you,
absolutely.
Joe. And John, thank you for your time.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, I want you to know it's the Avila family really we owe most of the thanks to, actually all of the thanks to, for AR15.com. They own the site. They approved this show, and they gave us this forum, this great forum, to be able to get the word out about people just like yourself. Thanks for your time,
and
I'll make sure we get you on again, Graham. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good one, John.
Take care, John.
Okay, you guys have a good one, too. Coming up next, you guys, we're going to have a blogger who has spent a lot of time studying, examining, and doing intelligence analyst briefs about the war on drugs and specifically the violence going on in Mexico. Her website is called BorderViolenceAnalysis.typepad.com. BorderViolenceAnalysis.typepad.com. Her name is Sylvia Longmire, and we're going to be working on getting her live here shortly. Once she's online, she's got a lot to talk about, and I have several very interesting questions for her. Violence down on the border between the United States and Mexico has skyrocketed over the last couple of months. It's just totally out of hand. The mainstream media refuses to cover it, and I don't understand what their agenda is to not cover this. This is a serious security threat, and if you are an American, this is something that you should be very, very concerned about. Our border is completely out of control down there. No one wants to talk about it. The politicians only want to talk about health care. Now they want to talk about amnesty. They're not even... I haven't even heard a politician even say anything about this. We actually had a helicopter incursion from a Mexican military helicopter incurred over the border into U.S. airspace a couple of weeks ago was detailed in the Houston Chronicle, and I actually put the story up on AR15.com in the GD section, so it should be on there. Apparently we have Sylvia on. Sylvia, are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to have you on. Thanks for taking some time out of your day. I know you're really busy. I know you've got family in town from out of town, and we appreciate having you on.
Yeah, no problem. It's my pleasure.
Before we get started into the current news and that, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about your background, where you come from as far as getting involved in covering this violence down there on the border and the cartels and that type of thing.
Sure, no problem. I'm a former military. I was an Air Force officer for 8.5 years. During that time, I was a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. A few years into my career, I went to graduate school to get a master's degree in Latin American and Caribbean studies and then became the desk officer for Latin America Affairs. After I was medically retired in 2005, we're a military family, so I followed my husband to Northern California, and there I became a senior intelligence analyst as a contractor for the state of California's Office of Homeland Security, where I worked as the senior analyst for Southwest border issues. So I was advising the governor's office staff and other senior folks in state management on border violence, who's who in the zoo when it comes to the cartels, and working with different state and local agencies in Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico on different issues regarding border security, and just becoming familiar with the different cartels and the shifting tactics, and doing analytical assessments for things regarding Southwest border security. I had to leave California in summer of last year, so I became a freelance writer and an independent consultant. So in the last 8 months or so, I've been writing for my personal blog. I've also been writing for Homeland Security Today magazine. I'm the South America Policy Examiner for Examiner.com. I also write articles for Mexidata.info and just, you know, write for different outlets here and there. But, yeah, that's my main focus right now is Mexico's drug war.
I think there's absolutely no question that you're completely qualified to talk about this.
I hope so.
Yeah. That's an impressive resume. What have you noticed, not specifically in the last couple of months with this huge spike, but over the last few years, the evolution of this war between the cartels down there and between the government and the cartels? What are some of the big things that you've noticed as far as the changes that have occurred?
Well, there's two main things that are going on. First of all, the shift in control over drugs moving from the Colombians to the Mexicans. That's the first main thing. You know, after we did such a great job in taking out the major cartels in Colombia, you know, the Cali and the Medellin cartels, and not necessarily completely shutting down, but really diminishing the activity of drug trafficking corridors in the Caribbean, that moved over to the Mexicans. And the Mexicans became so good at moving product from Colombia into the United States that they all of a sudden were able to start dictating terms to the Colombians. So they basically, they're in charge now. They just became really, really good at what they do, and they're still very good at what they do. So they've increased in power, in influence, and also in riches because of that. So we've seen an increase in their influence and the amount of product that they're moving into the United States across the land borders from Mexico. And the second thing we've seen is a dramatic shift in strategy by the Mexican government. You know, past governments, the PRI, which is, you know, a very powerful, well, it used to be a very powerful political party in Mexico, has a very long history of corruption and looking the other way when it comes to cartels. You know, it's not like the cartels just started operating in Mexico, you know, just a couple of years ago. They've been there for decades. It's just they've been operating with very little interference from the Mexican government. So all of a sudden, the current president, Felipe Calderón, he goes in there with, you know, with a strategy, with an agenda, and he really wants to crack down on the cartels, and he's, you know, trying to find a way to do that, and the way he's decided to do that is to employ the army, because out of all the tools that he has to work with, you know, the local cops are corrupt, you know, the federales, as they call them, the feds are slightly less corrupt than the locals, but they still have their serious corruption issues. So he's relying heavily in the Army. He's, you know, having problems with that too, but it's still the most severe crackdown on cartel activity that we've seen in decades. And unfortunately, while it is reaping some rewards, but it's also causing the violence to spiral out of control. And, you know, that's combined too with the inter-cartel rivalries that you see, fighting for territory and fighting for over drug trafficking routes. So, there are a lot of shifts and a lot of strategies and a lot of things that are going on that are contributing to that increase in violence that has happened over the last few years.
Okay, so just to clarify something, so eventually the Mexicans took total control of the drug trade, so now basically the Colombians are just working for them. They're just growing now and producing the cocaine for the Mexican cartels. The Mexican cartels basically have carte blanche over the entire operation. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say the entire operation. I mean, there are plenty of smaller cartels that are operating throughout Colombia and, you know, have their own thing going on that doesn't deal with the Mexicans, but, you know, they have to get it out of Colombia somehow. And, you know, there's still plenty of trafficking that's going on through the Caribbean, but it's, you know, such a small scale compared to how it used to be. But you've got groups like the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which is a designated foreign terrorist operation. The large majority of the cocaine that they produce gets distributed through Mexican cartels. It's just the most efficient and the most effective way to get product out of Colombia, and they know that they have to work with the Mexicans in order to get it out. So I wouldn't say that, you know, they, you know, dominate 100% of Colombian production and transportation, but I would say that probably the largest majority of it is controlled to some extent by the Mexican cartels.
Okay. I'm looking on page 2 of your blog, and you've got that map on there that was from the Mexican Attorney General's office that kind of details all the areas that each of the cartels holds. And it looks like there's 6 major organizations down there in Mexico. Can you kind of talk about the big players and who is actually causing the most problems right now with this huge uptick in violence we've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and that's 6. That number 6 is shifting even as we speak. And, you know, every year the number's different. I mean, just like 2 years ago, we only had 3. And then we were up to 6, and now maybe we're going down to 5 or even 4. I'll kind of start from the west and work my way east. First you have the Arellano Felix organization, also known as the Tijuana Cartel, and they operate mostly in the northern Baja California Peninsula. That's a cartel that I dealt with, or at least, you know, studied the most when I was in California, simply because their main blasts or drug corridors run from, you know, Tijuana into the San Diego area, but they're also, you know, going across from Mexicali into Calexico, into El Centro, and all along the California border. Arellano Felix organization used to be known as one of the most brutal cartels in Mexico, and they were a family organization. It was 7 brothers, and all of them have either been killed or arrested. So right now it's being run by the nephew of one of the original brothers, and, you know, he's a younger guy. He's not as experienced. He's getting some help from one of the sisters who's an accountant and, you know, pretty good at, you know, running the books and all that, but that cartel really has been decimated. What happened back in April of 2008 was that one of the senior lieutenants in the cartel decided to defect and go work for the Sinaloa Federation in neighboring Sinaloa. And his name is Teodoro. He goes by El Teo Garcia Cimentan. Some of you may have heard of him. He was recently arrested. And he decided to go to war against Fernando Sanchez Arellano, who was running the rents of the AFO. And that caused an enormous spike in violence in the Tijuana area. The spike was really just absolutely absurd because of that split. Now, El Teo was arrested in January, I believe. But he had a guy, you know, his right-hand man was ready to take over, you know, so some people were saying, hey, you know, this is gonna be great, but they always have somebody ready to take over. Well, fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, in February, his right-hand guy and also his brother were arrested. And that was kind of the end of that. And everybody, you know, some folks were happy, like saying, hey, you know, the government arrested these guys. That's great. You know, maybe this is the end of it. But unfortunately, that's leading kind of a power vacuum right now in the Tijuana area who's going to take control of the operations that they were running. So we're kind of waiting for that area to blow up even more to see if the Sinaloa Federation, who was backing El Deo, is going to come in and send somebody to take over, or if what's left of the AFO is going to come in and kind of, you know, take that territory or take those operations back. So Tijuana is really probably the second biggest hot spot in Mexico right now, next to Ciudad Juarez, and we'll kind of work our way over there. Next, you have the Sinaloa Federation. Most people have heard of El Chapo, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Laura. He is probably the biggest kingpin in all of Mexico. Very, very difficult to track this guy down, even get pictures of him. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, where's Waldo? Where's Bin Laden? You know, trying to figure out where this guy is. He's, you know, he's vicious. He's brutal. He's also a very smart businessman. And, you know, he's very, very good at what he does, and absolutely brutal in tactics. And he hasn't become the most powerful drug lord in Mexico without a good reason. So the Sinaloa Federation is by far the most powerful cartel in Mexico. They also have the largest amount of territory right now. And it's called the Federation because really it's kind of a compendium of several smaller cartels in Mexico right now. Now, a third, you know, one of the third cartel out of the six, and kind of used to be, this is one of those that's on its way out the door, is the Beltran Leyva organization. That was another family-run cartel, and several of the top brothers have been recently either arrested or killed as well. Alfredo and Arturo, they're out of the picture, so now the Beltran Leyva organization is falling apart, and they used to be a part of the Sinaloa Federation. So now we're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen to what's left of the Beltran Leyva organization, if they're going to try to, you know, filter back in to the Sinaloa, if they're going to try to maybe form an alliance with a rival cartel. That one's kind of up in the air, too, and that could lead to increased violence in areas where the BLO was operating before. Next, you have La Familia Michoacana. They weren't even really on the map about a year and a half ago, and then all of a sudden, they're really kind of getting in the picture because of two things. Obviously, the violence, you know, the violence thing that they're known for. But also, La Familia Michoacana is a very unusual phenomenon in Mexico because they're almost like a cult. They have a sociological factor that some of the other cartels just don't have. You know, they have a cult of personality around the head of that particular cartel, and they get involved in the communities. You know, it's almost like a religion following these guys and what they do. You know, they help with the communities. They even loan out money. They work like a bank. They started trying to, you know, commit crimes to get people to stop using meth because they thought meth was like the scourge of the devil. Well, now the, you know, meth is like the product they deal the most in, ironically enough. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's more in La Familia in my blog and just how really unusual that cartel is. But they're increasing in power because of their brutal tactics. They want to send a message and say, hey, we're here on the map, and it's an ugly way that they have to do that. So they're growing and making some alliances in Mexico. Next, you have the Gulf Cartel. The Gulf Cartel used to be much bigger and more powerful than they are now. They operate, called the Gulf Cartel, because they operate mostly along the Gulf of Mexico and along the Mexico border with Texas. And the Gulf Cartel used to be run by Ocías Cárdenas Guillén, but he was arrested and extradited to the United States a few years ago and recently underwent a very secret trial in Houston. A colleague of mine who's a reporter for the Houston Chronicle was covering it, and it was absolutely crazy that, you know, nobody knew anything about what was going on with this guy. So even though he's been out of the picture and he was in jail, he was running the cartel from jail for a long time, but it's been falling apart ever since he got extradited. So the Gulf Cartel is still ongoing, but they're much weaker than they used to be. And the, you know, the next cartel that we have to look at is Los Zetas, who used to be the enforcement arm for the Gulf Cartel. They used to be kind of a part of that cartel, but and Los Zetas are former Mexican Army Special Forces soldiers, extremely, extremely good at what they do. The word is that many of them were trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, here in the United States. They are very well armed. Oh, They are very well trained experts in surveillance, counter surveillance, urban warfare, hostage rescue, prison escapes, you name it, and these guys know how to do it. So Los Zetas, after Cadenas Guillen was extradited, started to acquire a little bit more power, and instead of just becoming the hired help, they kind of, you know, ended up branching out on their own, and now they've become their own cartel. And it used to be that Los Zetas in the Gulf maintained that good relationship, but just in the last few weeks, we started to see a war between Los Zetas and the Gulf cartel. So now, you know, Nuevo Laredo has always been a hot spot for violence, but, you know, Ciudad Juarez was the center of everything. So now we're seeing more heat in Nuevo Laredo because of the war that started, you know, that just started a few weeks ago between the Gulf cartel and Los Zetas. And, you know, I'm reading that La Familia Michoacana is getting involved in that. Possibly, you know, the former BLO is getting involved in that. So these are smaller cartels or diminishing cartels that are looking for friends. They're looking to stay relevant. They're looking to stay active in the business aspect of drug trafficking. And it's just a lot of shifts and a lot of things that are going on right now with the number of cartels and who's friends with who. And that's, you know, getting a lot of people caught in the violence in the process.
So the recent surge in violence there along the eastern Texas border with Mexico, that's this war between the Los Zetas and the Gulf cartel, and then you're saying these other cartels are coming involved. Does it look like there's going to be one group get the upper hand over another group, or is this just going to be an ongoing bloodbath and we won't know who's going to win it until it's over? What is your view on that?
Well, you know, I wish I could answer that. If you were talking to me about, you know, maybe Sinaloa and AFO, it might be more clear cut, but because the number of people involved with the smaller cartels is fluctuating, you know, so much from day to day, and who's killing who, you know, changes so much from day to day, it's really hard to put me, you know, if I had to put money on a horse, I'd really have a hard time doing that. You know, the Gulf was starting to become a little bit stronger in the last, I would say, 6 months, but then this happened with Los Zetas. And Los Zetas, you know, I got to tell you, based on their training, based on, you know, their experience and the fact that they've been kind of running operations for the Gulf cartel for the last, I guess, you know, 5 years or so, puts them really in a position to be a front runner when all the, you know, everything kind of ends up just, you know, falling out and we figure out what's left. The BLO doesn't have much left, you know, but La Familia Michoacana is an up-and-comer, you know, and they're just so different, and they really have a lot of support from, you know, from the people, from Mexicans from which they're getting social services. You know, they're unusual, and because of that unusual factor, that they have support from the Mexican people, whereas other cartels don't because of that fear factor. You know, that might give La Familia a little more power and a little more influence, and depending on who they choose to align themselves with, that would make that organization a front runner. I mean, if I absolutely had to put my money on somebody, I would say probably those Zetas would end up being stronger, coming out the strongest out of all of them, simply because of their training, you know, the weaponry they have, the amount of money that they're working with, and their experience. But, you know, and that horse race, really, it's anybody's guess.
That's scary, scary stuff if those guys are the guys.
Yeah.
That end up taking over. I mean, if they're trained at Fort Benning, you said, which is where we train most of our special forces, and that's scary stuff right there. That,
yeah.
We couldn't foresee that. Now, there was this recent attack here last week on the U.S. consulate employees, and I read on your blog that you said you weren't sure that they were specifically targeted because they were American or because they were associated with the consulate. Has anything changed since you posted that?
I was reading an article, and, you know, this is just open source stuff. I haven't, you know, talked to anybody in the FBI directly, but I was reading an article that the FBI was saying that they were targeted. It wasn't a random thing. You know, somebody was specifically seeking them out to kill them, but unfortunately that reason hasn't been made clear, at least not to me or the general public. You know, somebody might know why. Now, you know, it's it's hard to believe or hard to say that, you know, that these folks were dirty and they were targeted because they wronged some kind of cartel. It's tempting to say that, you know, they were targeted because they were American. I mean, that would be too huge of a deal, and I'm not really going to go there because it would just represent too big of a strategic change in the cartel's tactics. You know, that just makes no sense, and what really would it accomplish to, you know, kill somebody working at the consulate just because they work there? So, you know, I can only speculate at this point, but the FBI is saying that they were selected for assassination, but I don't know specifically why.
Wow, that's scary. If they have changed to get that bold, it could either mean that they're feeling really strong or they're feeling really pushed into a corner, right?
Yeah, one or the other. And I mean, you know, right now, and it's not confirmed, you know, the word on the street is that Barrio Azteca is involved, which is, you know, one of the gangs that's working with the cartels. You know, why Barrio Azteca, you know, got involved, or, you know, why they would target these folks on behalf of a cartel, you know, that I don't know. I'm sure there are, you know, other analysts that could speculate that are a little more familiar with Barrio Azteca, but just that these folks would get targeted at all, it's one of those things that just makes me curious. You know, who did they know, or what were they working on? Were they working on something specific at the consulate, or maybe they were working on somebody's case? You know, maybe there was somebody that was, you know, high level in the cartel that was looking to provide information to a government agency, and the folks that were working in the consulate were trying to help them. You know, there are so many different scenarios that might lead to these folks' unfortunate and untimely death that, you know, we could talk about that and speculate all day. You know, the FBI definitely knows more about the case than I do. But yeah, it's scary that something like that would happen, and obviously a lot of people are taking notice of what's going on because of that incident.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the spillover into the United States. There have been people killed on the United States side of the border, even a few American citizens, if I'm right, but they've all been somehow involved with the drug cartels or the drug trade in one way or the other. Is there a legitimate fear that this is going to spill over and that the average American citizen is going to end up feeling some of this? We're going to have normal citizens not involved in the drug trade, law-abiding citizens that are going to be killed, they're going to be caught in a crossfire, that type of thing?
Well, you know, it depends on who you ask, really, but I don't think it's time to panic. You know, probably 99% of the people that are affected by what's going on in Mexico on U.S. soil are somehow involved in the drug trade, like you said. You know, it's been all over the news about how Phoenix is the you know, U.S. kidnapping capital and all this other stuff, and it's true. I mean, U.S. has had a huge rash of kidnappings recently, but, you know, if you take a look at the news stories and the video and everything, there's a sergeant that works for the Phoenix PD. I can't remember what his name is. It was just really kind of amusing. He's sitting there, you know, in the interview on TV and saying, yeah, you know, most of these guys, you know, we do the investigation, we find where they're being kept in a safe house, and they're all chained up and half naked and everything, and we release them and we take them to the hospital, make sure they're okay, and then we turn around and put handcuffs on them and send them to jail because they're a drug dealer, because, you know, they've kidnapped or killed somebody or whatever. So, you know, if you're a citizen living in Phoenix and you go, you know, holy crap, this is going on in my city, should I be scared? There's these safe houses and neighborhoods and tract homes that look perfectly normal and perfectly suburban, and you know, should I worry for my kids going to school? And I'm like, you know, not really, because it's not being targeted towards American citizens or, you know, innocents and just people going about, you know, their daily lives. These are cartels that hire people out on U.S. soil to do this sort of thing, and they target people that have somehow wronged them, you know, either lost a load or they've stolen some money, and it's ugly business, and it's scary that it's going on under our noses, but there are task forces, you know, law enforcement is just, you know, they're busting their humps to try to get the situation under control and keep it under control, and I know Phoenix PD has task forces, San Diego has task forces, and a lot, you know, El Paso, a lot of the major border cities have law enforcement agents that are specifically assigned to deal with those issues. And, you know, they'll tell you what I'm telling you is that this is an issue of, you know, mostly criminal against criminal. So, yeah, it concerns a lot of us. And, you know, I would be concerned if I were living in a place like Phoenix just to hear about it. But a lot of news is sensationalist. You know, that's one of the things that I try to do on my blog, is to kind of try to explain to people when some of these news stories come out. It's like, look, you know, you read about this and you hear that all these kidnappings are going on, or you know, these gang killings are going on. But, you know, you got to look a little bit deeper and find out, you know, who's doing the killing, who are the victims, you know, why this is going on, and realize they're not going to come into your kid's school and spray it down with, you know, automatic weapons and kill your kids and all this other stuff. You know, it's the media reporting is sometimes gets a little bit out of hand when it comes to that. So no, I don't see the average everyday American citizen just going to the supermarket or taking their kid to daycare or anything like that being affected. Now, if you're living in a neighborhood in, you know, Chula Vista that is known for, you know, gang activity or wherever, you know, you're going to have gang activity no matter what, you know, whether it's you know, Mexican drug trade related, or whether it's just, you know, a local gang involved in, you know, carjackings and thefts and drug dealings. You know, you're not going to know. You just know that there's shooting going on and there's gang violence going on, but that's something that's been going on for, you know, years and for decades. So that's a bad neighborhood's going to be a bad neighborhood regardless. So you're going to have, you know, drive-by shootings and that sort of gang thing, but not all of a sudden where we're going to see a spike in, you know, violence in just your average suburban areas and cities where people are going about their daily business. I just don't see that happening.
Okay. Well, we've got you here for just a few more minutes. I invite any callers, if you have any questions for Sylvia Longmire, please call in and ask right now while we've got a chance. I'm going to ask you a very controversial question. It gets brought up all the time on our website. We at least seems like we have at least one thread a week about this. Well, are you still there, Sylvia? Okay, looks like we lost Sylvia. We'll get her right back shortly. I'm going to ask her the ARFCOM question about the drug war, and I think you guys know what it is. We'll see her right when we get her back on here shortly. I invite everyone to go check out her blog while you're listening. It's called BorderViolenceAnalysis.typepad.com. She's very, very intelligent person. Some of the stuff she puts on here is really eye-opening. When you see some of the problems. Actually, her latest blog post is about money laundering and why it's so hard for in Mexico for the Mexican government to crack down on the money laundering, that's caused a huge it's given a huge help. Is she back now?
Yeah, right before the controversial question. I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Right. I didn't ask it. Yeah, I heard you drop off. But here it is.
Oh,
here's
okay.
The question. We talk about it all the time. U.S. is obviously the market for all these drugs. The money comes from the U.S., flows back into Mexico. If the U.S. legalizes drugs, and regulates them, and the production, I don't know what would happen with the production. Is this something that would solve this problem? Would the cartels then be hamstrung, or do you just see that if the U.S. legalized drugs, the cartels would move in on the legal operations?
Well, you know, it's not even that controversial anymore, because, you know, anybody who analyzes it from a business perspective would realize that it would be a massive financial hit on the cartels. Now, I wrote an article back in the December issue of Homeland Security Today magazine on Al Capone and the lessons that we could learn for Mexico's drug war based on what happened with Al Capone back in the 1920s, you know, during Prohibition. And, you know, they weren't in a drug trafficking, you know, situation, but it was, you know, bootlegging, and, you know, Prohibition was in full effect. But
right. It
wasn't just bootlegging that was going on. You had gambling and prostitution and all this other stuff. So what happened when Prohibition was repealed and all of a sudden, you know, liquor and beer and all that stuff became legal? Yeah, you know, organized crime took a huge financial hit in not just Chicago, you know, but in other areas in the United States. But it's not like organized crime completely went away. I mean, we know we have organized crime in cities and, you know, throughout the United States still to this day, and they're involved in other things. You know, they're still involved in, prostitution and gambling and other kinds of racketeering, but obviously the money that they're making is nowhere near where it would have been if it was, you know, Prohibition. So would I think that it would solve the problem? No. I don't think that you have I don't think there's a silver bullet. However, I think it would put a really huge dent in cartel profits. You know, and it depends on, you know, you wouldn't be able to legalize everything. You know, even if you just did marijuana, you know, marijuana is, I think, the largest volume drug that's being trafficked by the Mexican cartels into the United States. So, you know, even if you just did marijuana, that would probably be the biggest hit, but you still have cocaine, you still have black tar heroin, you still have methamphetamine, you know, and those are, you know, methamphetamine is, you know, cheaper than some of the other drugs, not as cheap, at least on the street, as marijuana in some cases. But, you know, cartels could still turn to the other types of drugs. Plus, they're looking into other markets. You know, let's say we legalize marijuana tomorrow. They're expanding into Africa. They're expanding into Europe. So, you know, this is like a global situation. It's not like it's just the demand in the United States, although obviously, you know, right across the border, and that's where obviously their biggest market. So, yeah, I think it would have a huge impact, but I don't think it's going to be the silver bullet solution to the problem.
Okay, we spoke a little bit, or you blogged a little bit actually, about the Mexican government has been trying more with this administration, their current administration, to fight against this, using the army and whatnot. Now, if I understand everything correctly, they actually legalized drug use in Mexico last year, is that correct?
They didn't legalize, and there's, you know, and that's kind of legal semantics, that there's a difference between legalization and decriminalization. So what they did was they decriminalized personal use amounts, and I don't know the exact amounts, but basically if they catch you on the street with a certain amount of marijuana or a certain amount of cocaine or LSD, you know, they don't punish you the way that they used to. You know, if they it's like a misdemeanor, they just kind of, you know, they like write you a ticket instead of throwing you in jail. However, it's not legalized in the sense that you can open up a shop and, you know, sell, you know, 50,000 marijuana cigarettes or, you know, little bags of cocaine. So that's kind of the difference between decriminalization and legalization. So, yeah, they decriminalized small personal use amounts.
Did that change anything? Did that change any of the dynamics as far as the cartels and the violence and that type of thing?
You know, not real, at least not yet, but it wasn't, and again, depending on who you ask, I don't think it was really designed to be a major blow. I think it was more designed to alleviate pressure on the justice system and also on the jails and the correctional facilities. I'm still waiting to see any kind of, you know, report summarizing the effects. You know, it just hasn't been long enough. It's been a matter of months. You know, that's one of those things that we won't see for maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years if there's been any kind of effect. But yeah, it wasn't designed to shut anybody down. It's just designed to maybe make the justice system work a little more smoothly and not clog it up with, you know, just a bunch of guys that were smoking a joint on the corner and the cops decided to throw them in jail for the night.
Right. I've got so many more questions for you, but we're completely out of time, Sylvia. Can we get you back on in a month or two kind of go over
absolutely.
Some more things? Because I have a ton of questions to ask you. I will be following your blog. I encourage all our listeners to follow her blog. Her name is Sylvia Longmire. Her blog is borderviolenceanalysis.typepad.com. And I want to thank you for taking some time out and joining us today, Sylvia. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me, John. I really appreciate it.
All right, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, take care.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, we are going to now do a get-to-know segment. We've got one of our newer residents here at AR15.com. His name's Gon Shootin, and this is his get-to-know. On this get-to-know, we have one of our more recent members to join the ARFCOM Brigade. His name is Gon Shootin. He joined back in June of 2007. How are you today, Gon?
Pretty good. How about you?
Doing well. Why don't we get straight to the questions?
Okay.
9mm, sir, or 45?
I guess 45. I see the merits of both, but my favorite handgun is a 45, so go with 45.
Makes sense. All right. One of the big ones here. Beans or no beans?
Beans.
Beans all the way? Well, you're an ordinary guy. Go with beans, right?
Way I grew up. Sorry.
Okay. Glock 1911 or something else?
1911.
We knew that was coming. What do you do for a living?
I drive truck.
Oh, you do? And then, if I understand correctly, you actually make runs up into Canada?
Yep.
Okay. So you cross over the border. Do they ever ask you any firearms questions when you cross over the border up there?
Oh, yeah, every time, going both ways. Do you have any firearms, knives, weapons, pepper mace, anything like that, you know, ask me if I have anything like that. So.
So how does that work? I mean, so do you just aren't allowed to carry any weapons across the border, or you are but only certain ones, or what are the rules?
I think if somebody's going up there hunting and if they have a permit to go hunting, they can bring their hunting rifle or a shotgun or whatever. But as far as truck drivers, I don't think they'll let a truck driver bring guns back and forth.
That sucks, Canada, you know. Let's see here. When you're settling in on a Friday evening for a nice long session of ARFCOM, what is your drink of choice?
Well, I'm a pretty boring guy in that department. It's usually water.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
If I feel like drinking, I sip on some Jack and Coke or something like that. You know.
Oh, okay. Jack, I love Jack. Who is your favorite poster on ARFCOM?
Basically anybody that makes me laugh. Anybody that has a sense of humor. So, I don't have any one favorite, but...
Oh, nobody leaps to mind when you say that?
Well, some that you had on last week. He's a funny guy.
He is a funny guy.
Yeah. Swing Set.
Swing Set. He's got a couple of books
now. I'm drawing
a
blank now.
That's fine. Swing Set. He's a good guy. He's running a close second, I think, to Old Painless under our favorite posters. Yeah. Who is your least favorite poster, or what type of person is your least favorite poster?
Basically people that just can't take a joke, you know.
Oh, yes, the all-too-serious types?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And you'd think, you know, especially in GD, you'd think there'd be a lot less of that. But there are a lot of people that take themselves extremely seriously.
Oh, yeah.
Who is your favorite ARFCOM mod or site stack?
I get a kick out of the system messages that, like, VA Gun Nut in 82nd and some of the other guys like that put up. They put some funny stuff up there.
There have been some good ones, too. There certainly have been some good ones. Let's see. If you could live anywhere other than Minnesota, where would that be?
Back home in Iowa, where I grew up.
Oh, okay. You're from Iowa originally. Okay. Let's see. Next question is, what is your favorite firearm that you currently own?
That's probably my Sweet Mauser.
Oh, really? How did you get that?
I found it at Cabela's down in Rogers. I stopped in there when I was out in the truck, and they had it there, $350, in pretty good shape. So I went ahead and nailed it down, and I've got a CNR, so I just had them ship it to me, you know. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. How do you like that CNR? Do you do a lot with that?
Not as much as I thought I would, you know, but... I mainly use it for the discounts I can get.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember Old Painless talked about that in one of his Box of Truths a few weeks ago about CNR and the discounts you could get with that CNR license. I think that's pretty cool. If you could have any one firearm that's legal for you to own and that you do not currently own, what would that be?
Probably a LaRue OSR.
Oh.
Or okay. OBR. I'm sorry, they changed it.
Yeah, I know what you're
OBR.
Talking
about. OBR. Yep.
Cool. Oh, yeah, LaRue makes good stuff, too. We all know that.
Yeah.
When was the last time you went shooting?
Last fall.
Oh, wow, so it's been a while. You've got to get to the range, man. I know you drive a lot. We got to get your butt to the range.
We had a lot of snow this winter, and now the range I usually go to has a big little pond in it right now. So.
Oh, wow.
From the snow melt. So
got to wait for the water to clear off, huh? Make sure you get your butt out there to the range.
Yep.
Okay. What is your favorite non-GD section of the forums?
For me, that's a tie between music and musicians and the AK discussions.
Oh, okay. You're an AK lover. Okay. And the
music. Yeah, well, I like it over there a little better because they're more laid back, seems like.
Oh, okay. Okay. See, I have barely touched the AK section, and I have not even been in the music section yet, so I need to go check that one out. Have you ever gotten rid of a firearm and regretted it?
Yeah.
Well, tell me the story.
Well, one of them was a Ruger Blackhawk and .45 Long Colt, and I, you know, stupid move, I traded it off. I shouldn't have. Then the other one was my first Swedish Mauser. I traded it off too.
Oh, so you had a Mauser before?
Yeah, it was a Bubba hack job. Somebody drilled and tapped it for scope mounts and put a sporter stock on it. And one day I decided, I don't want it. It's not original, but I should have kept it, you know.
Should have kept it and restored it yourself.
Yeah.
What was the first firearm you shot? You ever shot? Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was a it's an old Remington Model 20. I think it was a Model 27. It was one of them semi-automatic 22s that had the tubular magazine in the stock, you know, where you twist it 90 degrees and pull the spring-loaded deal out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't know they made those in semi-auto. I did not know that.
Yep. And it belonged to my dad's uncle, and then when he died, it went to my granddad. And then my dad wound up with it. And, yeah, I think I was about, I don't know, 3 or 4. My dad took me out and held it up for me and let me pull the trigger, you know.
And you were hooked ever since, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's great. That's great. Tell me a little bit about your avatar.
I was doing some searches for old warbirds and stuff and ran across that one. It's a picture of a P-47 firing its guns off at night. And, you know, just stuck in my head, so I changed it to that. Before, it was the inside of the barrel out of my Kimber. But
okay.
I was getting bored with that one, so.
How long have you had that particular avatar up?
It was last year sometime. I can't remember exactly when I changed it.
Okay. Yeah, see, sometimes people change their avatar so fast and I get all confused because I'm so used to just looking at the picture and knowing who it is, and then they change the avatar.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, who is that? The worst was when Amos changed his avatar from his penguin to a different one, and I had no clue when he was posted anymore, but I'm glad he changed it back.
Yeah, that screwed with me for a while, too. Then I realized, oh, wait.
Yeah, oh, wait, that's Aimless. Oh, wait, okay, I got to get used to that. Last question. Here we go. If you were elected President of the United States, what would be the first thing you did as president?
Oh, it'd be really, really tempting to declare martial law and start arresting all these people that are screwing with the Constitution, but I don't know. That wouldn't be the right thing to do. I'd definitely get together a group of people to look into repealing, you know, stuff like the machine gun ban and the 1968 Gun Control Act and the NFA and all that stuff.
Outstanding. Second Amendment rights all the way.
Yep.
I love it. Okay. You know, they have the resistance shoot up there in Minnesota every year. DPMS does it. Are you going to be going this year?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. I forget what date was that.
I believe it is April 24th and 25th, I believe. And we're going to have someone from DPS on the show, from DPMS on the show. They're going to come talk about it and tell us all about it.
Oh, so yeah, I've been thinking about it, so.
I believe their website is outbreakomega.com. I think that's what it is. Yeah, it looks really cool. If I lived up there, I would definitely be going. That's a really cool little event.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I appreciate you taking some time out, getting off the road for a minute, and letting us talk to you on a little get-to-know segment. And safe out there on the road, okay?
Yeah. Have a good evening.
Okay. Talk to you next time. And we're back live on Radio Free Arfcom. I'm your host, John Gold. A little bit of that interview cut out right at the beginning, just for the record, I want everyone to know, that was Gon Shooten. He is a Beans guy. He's a 45 guy, and he's a 1911 guy. When I put the podcast up, I'll make sure I edit in his entire interview, including the part that got left out there. We're going to go straight to our next guest. We've already got him online. His name's Mike Vanderbo. For those who don't know, his blog is called the Sipsy Street Irregulars.blogspot.com. It's one of the more interesting blogs you will ever run across, especially if you consider yourself a true patriot. This guy is what I would consider a true patriot, and it's good to have you on, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, I don't even want to waste time and talk about your background right now, although we will get into that later. But let's go straight into this Window Wars thing. The Window Wars story is pretty famous on the internet. For those that don't know, you can just do a search for Window Wars and you'll find it. But why don't you talk about these recent events, what's happened here in the last week since the 19th?
Well, I took a look at the healthcare bill. There's been a lot of discussion amongst my friends and on the internet about how absolutely tyrannical and unconstitutional this is. The essence of the bill is this. The federal government dictates to us, to all of us, to our children, everyone in the country, that we must buy a certain government-approved insurance, or else. Or else is a fine. Now, if we refuse to pay that fine, as we all know, eventually someone will come to arrest us. If we resist arrest at the point of a federal gun, then we'll be killed. Ironic way to try to ensure our health care by killing us, but that is the logical outflow of this law. And then, to add beef to it, this law adds 16,500 new IRS agents to enforce it. Now, you may recall that recently the IRS was found to be buying numbers of 14-inch barrel Mossberg entry guns. So, too, in fact, was the Federal Department of Education buying short-barreled shotguns. What do they know that we don't know? What I did was, making the connection, saying, look, these people are threatening deadly violence to us. They do not understand how close this country is to an outbreak of civil war. And so I suggested on my blog that we break their windows, that we use the tactics of the Sons of Liberty, just as I had written in the fictional story 10 years ago, that now was the time to begin breaking their windows, and I asked for the breaking of the windows of local Democratic Party headquarters, city and county headquarters. I did not call for the breaking the windows of Congress people, specifically because I didn't want to be responsible for people breaking federal law, breaking a window in a local Democratic Party headquarters is just a misdemeanor vandalism charge. Whatever the motive is, but before even my call to Modern Sons of Liberty to break their windows last Friday, someone got to the Niagara Falls office of Congresswoman Slaughter, of the famed Dean and Pass maneuver, and broke her window. Then over the weekend, we've had windows broken in Rochester, New York, with a message on the brick that said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice," the quote from Barry Goldwater. We've had windows broken in party headquarters in Wichita, Kansas, with, quote, anti-Obama slogans on the brick. Also, over the weekend, the office of a congresswoman in Tucson, Arizona, was broken as well. And they're not entirely sure what did that. They can't find the projectile. Slingshots, I understand, are very popular these days. I had a buddy go to a local Walmart, and he was complaining because he couldn't find one. In any case, there are windows being broken. The powers that be, and at least the media powers that be, have taken notice. I'm getting calls from all over the country, radio shows, CNN, the New York Times, and the Drudge Report noted the vandalism in New York, but they haven't yet made a connection to my blog. But I imagine that that's just a day away from happening. And obviously what I've done here is in calling for vandalism, political vandalism, I'm standing right on the line of sedition, okay? A froggy prosecutor might conclude that I have violated that, and they may yet come to arrest me. But what I am trying to do by calling for the breaking of windows is to save these people's lives, to prevent civil war, because they do not understand the unintended consequences of what they do. When a congresswoman in New York or in Arizona votes for a bill, the logical conclusion of which is, I will submit or they will kill me, or you, or someone that you love. When they do that, and they have no idea how the other side of this equation thinks. We are so divided as a people. If we cannot agree on whether which is to be the master, the government or the people. The founders said it was the people, right? And these people are proceeding from the point of view that it is the government that is the master. And there are people who will resist that violently. There are people who the founders wanted to resist that violently. That's why we have the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is, at base, not about hunting fuzzy creatures. It's about maintaining a credible deterrence of violence in the citizenry, in the armed citizenry, so that if the government gets out of line, that the citizenry can have the means to resist that. So by calling for bricks through windows, I'm trying to prevent gunshots in this country. I'm trying to prevent a civil war in this country because, I don't know if you hear it, but in the background, I can hear the snick-snick of 3 million rifles being cleaned right now. We are that close. People, I get comments on the blog and email messages. You know, when do we go? When do we go? When do we go? And I keep saying, not now, not yet. Don't react. And these are people who are just finally so tired of being shoved back from the free exercise of our rights, as we have been since the 1934 Firearms Act, that they say, well, you know, if they don't get this, talking about the other side, if they don't get that what they are doing is threatening us with violence, then, you know, I better get ready for it. And frankly, if you look at all the guns and ammunition that have been sold in this country in the last year, obviously somebody, you know, just more than me and you believes that.
Without a doubt. It's amazing, like you said, the amount of guns and ammunition that have been sold. What's also amazing to me is to see the conservatives, I mean the true conservatives, the real, you know, right-wing conservatives, and I'm not going to try to use any pejoratives towards them because I myself am one of those, a true right-wing conservative. I've never seen conservatives this angry, this upset, this riled up ever in my whole life. I've never seen it. I'm only 38 years old, but I've never seen it in my 38 years.
Well, I'm 57. I've never seen it either. This, and that's the thing, as I was trying to get across to the CNN reporterette who was talking to me, or producerette, whoever she was.
So you were on CNN today, correct?
Well, no, they just interviewed me on the phone just before I picked up to talk to you. I don't know where they're going from there. I did a New York radio show earlier today that's apparently getting a lot of press. But no, I told her, I said, the only reason you're calling me is this is a man bites dog story. You know, if an anarchist breaks a window, it's what is expected of it. If an ELF terrorist blows up or burns down a development and causes millions of dollars of property damage, you just sort of accept it, okay? You report it, but it doesn't astound you, okay? What astounds you is that here are people who are traditionally law-abiding people who have never, ever done anything like this in their lives. If you look at just the Tea Parties and how raucous the Tea Parties got, I was at a Tea Party Express thing here in Birmingham when the bus came through and they have the speakers and everything. And they were pumped up and they were happy and they were shouting out their defiance, but it was you know, middle class folks, okay, they just don't get worked up until the police told them that they had run over on their permit and they had to disperse immediately. And the crowd went instantly from one that was essentially boisterous and happy to make us bring out the hoses, which has a definite connotation in Birmingham.
Absolutely.
You know, try to make us and watch what happens. The crowd instantly turned to that raw edge of threatened retaliatory violence. And these are people who have never been in that position before, but they feel like that they are completely ostracized, that they are a despised minority within their own country, that their voice no longer counts, that politics is a rigged game, and that the federal courts cannot be counted on to sustain justice. And we are now to the point that the founders were. We are at that point. And it's important for the other side to understand that if they wish to avoid violence, they need to start comprehending that, and they need to start acting that way. Because we're not backing up anymore. And we're armed. And they can kill us, but you know, we'll shoot back. So they need to deal with that.
Your perspective is definitely, definitely interesting, I will say that. And your blog is very interesting. I've been following it now for a little over a year, almost a year and a half. How did you decide to start the blog? What was your motivation behind that? How did you decide, you know what, I need to start blogging this. I need to start putting this out there for everyone to see.
Well, I was blogging before I had a blog. What I was doing was writing essays and sending it to friends that I developed on the net, like David Kodria's War on Guns, which is another absolutely outstanding blog. The Western Rifle Shooters Association and folks like that. And finally, David, I think, got tired of the sheer volume of what I was putting out and said, look, Mike, you know, you got to get your own blog here, man. So I did, and it was a good idea. I initially got into writing on the Internet again. You know, again, I had been active in the 90s, but I got quite active after David Olofsson's case, the railroad job that the ATF did on him. And, you know, when a federal court decides that the defense expert cannot even touch a firearm, when the firearm is the entire evidence of the government, when a federal judge decides that a firearms expert for the defense cannot even touch that weapon, that only an ATF agent is capable of touching that weapon and deducing what happened with it. We're back to you know, the king's men and only the royal authorities are authorized to do anything. It also gets back to David Kodria's concept of law enforcement as the only ones, you know. And so out of that outrage, out of the Olofsson outrage, came, you know, all of my recent writing. And, you know, I often send emails to Jody Kiku, the ATF agent who railroaded Olofsson, and copy her with the latest stuff that, you know, where I sneer at the ATF and point out all of their many failings. I'm happy to say to them directly what I say, you know, on the net, or indeed behind their backs. I have no secrets. I lay it all out there.
Yeah, you definitely lay it all out there. I will not disagree with that. Talk a little bit about the 3 percenters and what the 3 percenters are. You talk about that a lot on your blog. I know most of my listeners already know what they are, but I'm sure there are some that don't. And for those that don't, will you please explain that?
Sure. Once I got going, you know, we call the blog Sipsey Street Irregulars because the first chapter of my novel, Absolved, begins with a shootout on Sipsey Street in an unnamed Alabama town when the ATF picks on the wrong Alabama good old boy. And when we were looking for a title, someone said, well, you know, what about the Baker Street irregulars, you know, the people that helped out Sherlock Holmes in the Conan Doyle stories. And I said, well, what you're saying is you mean like Sipsey Street irregulars? And they said, yeah, so that's where the name came from. The 3% is an attempt to pin down a number of our determined minority. History is made, for good or ill, by determined minorities. That has always been the case. If you look at the Revolution, which is where, you know, we take our authority. You know, we're all of us gun rights activists are originalists. We look at what the founders intended with the language, not what has been perverted. And so, looking back at the Revolution, there were approximately 3% of the population, the total number of colonists. Only 3% of those took the field against the king. They were actively supported by perhaps another 10%, and then another 20% were cheerleaders, making up roughly a third of the population. The other third on the other side were royalists. Many people don't know that there were actually more American colonists serving in the royal forces at the end of the war than there were serving in the revolutionary troops. And then, of course, there was the one-third in the middle that blew with the wind and took what came. Well, when we were trying to enunciate, you know, how we felt in terms of the fact that, look, we're not going to back up anymore, it seemed to me a stretch to claim that we were 3% of the population. But I certainly think that we are, us cold, dead hands types, are 3% of American gun owners. And since American gun owners make up about 100 million of the population, that means that there are 3 million constituting 3% of American gun owners that believe, and I guess I can very quickly enunciate our doctrine. We are the folks who the founders counted on to save the republic when everyone else abandoned it, and we will. There will be no more free Wacos and no more free Katrinas, for we are the 3%. We will not disarm. You cannot convince us. You cannot intimidate us. You can try to kill us if you think you can, but remember, we'll shoot back. We are not going away. We are not backing up another inch. And there are 3 million of us. Your move, Mr. Wannabe Tyrant. Your move.
Yeah, I read that in the margin on your blog. It's that's pretty motivating stuff. It makes people really think about what happened with the founding fathers and the original revolution in our country. Do you see it inevitable that there will eventually be some form of armed insurrection in this country, or do you still think that we have a chance here in November with a huge conservative backlash, and we vote all the bums out, get as many Republicans in as we can, and repeal some of this stuff?
There are several things going on at once that insert uncertainty into the question you just asked. For example, we may never get, well, let me take the basis first. First of all, you use the word insurrection. We are not revolutionaries, right? We look at the people who are undermining the Founders' Republic as the revolutionaries. It's a slow-moving revolution. It's a revolution on the line of Antonio Gramsci, the Italian socialist, who enunciated the way to achieve socialism by attacking the culture and gradually attacking the various underpinnings of the country. But they're the revolutionaries. We're not. We're restorationists. What we want is what we had. What we want is what the founders set up for us, minus, obviously, slavery and racial discrimination. You know, all of my friends believe that the Constitution applies to everyone, regardless of race, creed, color, or religion. And so that's what we want, right? But you know, we have all taken an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That oath is not to a man; it's not to a political party. And so we look on ourselves as not insurrectionists, but as defenders of the Republic against insurrection. That's the first point. The second point is, this may never get to a quote-unquote tyrannical attack upon the people, simply because there are so many existential threats out there. When you have a country that is monetizing its debt by printing money, you're in the middle of not only the most incredible debt that this country has ever been in, but in a quasi-depression. And all of these other, because of all of these, you know, bailouts and things, the system has not been flushed out as it normally does in a recession. Were the market forces at work, we would already be on the rise economically. But none of this has been allowed to happen because they've been paying off their buddies, you know, paying off bankers, paying off the union folks, you know. So we have yet to see the bottom of this economic abyss that we're staring into. And if that happens, this entire society could collapse. And so that's another reason why, you know, we need an armed citizenry, we need the 3%, is because it could well be, in the end, that we are the only ones who are standing, protecting our neighborhoods, our communities, you know, even our states, against the widespread collapse and anarchy that comes after that collapse. There are so many threats to this country right now that is why you see people buying guns and buying firearms and buying ammunition at such a rate. In an average year in the Bush administration, we purchased about 7 billion rounds of ammunition. As near as anybody can determine, in the past year, in a time of economic collapse, at a time when ammunition was going up in price by doubling for the most part, we bought something on the order of 15 billion rounds of ammunition. So more than twice as much. All right. That becomes a strategic military fact, right, to anybody, whether it's a would-be tyrant in the country or a gangbanger who wants to set himself up as king of the South Side. You know, they still have to get past the armed citizenry. On the other hand, the armed citizenry had better get its stuff in gear. It better be organized on neighborhood basis. It better be able to hit the 10 ring. And it just better be ready for whatever comes, because there are so many threats to this society right now, it is impossible to name them all. And we've never seen this, not this country, not really Western civilization since it recovered from the collapse of the Roman Empire, has Western civilization seen an existential threat like we face today.
It's interesting. We had economist Nathan Martin on the show a couple weeks ago. He said his view was inevitable with the monetarizing of the debt, that it was inevitable there would be some form of huge economic collapse. He wouldn't pin it down when, because he said you just can't pin it down when. But he said we've passed the point of no return economically, to where eventually we will have a collapse here in the next few years. That's very scary. You think about social unrest, and I don't think people really understand you know, sometimes we get carried away, especially here on ARFCOM, on AR15.com, and we're, you know, is it go time, is it go time, is it go time? I'm guilty of some of that myself. But the thought of true civil unrest is very frightening, but I think you've got to be prepared for it. You have to. And on your blog, you talk a little bit about if there is some type of civil unrest, how do you deal with it? You don't advocate actually joining a militia or a large group. Is that correct?
Well, that's not necessarily true. What
okay.
I say is that there are places for all manner of armed citizenry organizations. What I have been promoting recently is neighborhood defense organizations because of the existential threat. It is easier to recruit folks into the concept that we have to be ready to defend our own neighborhoods in a particular, say, Katrina-type situation, where, you know, the lessons of Katrina are very interesting. I mean, you know, half the cops ran away to see to their families. Some of the cops joined in the looting. Then others tried to disarm law-abiding citizens and killed a few of them in the process. Becoming a gang of their own themselves. It is easier to organize people along those lines. They can more easily see the threat. And my attitude is, if you have a group that is competent at the task of the armed citizenry, that can carry out basic military tasks at the fire team and the squad level, then that becomes a deterrent force, whether it's societal collapse or government tyranny. And the advantage of having a small group is that you're organizing people that you know, friends, neighbors. The likelihood of a government snitch or provocateur getting into those groups is almost nil. Now, there's still a role for larger public units, and I think where that comes in is in particular becoming liaisons, developing a liaison relationship, a force multiplier relationship with your local county sheriff. I'm with Sheriff Mack. The county sheriffs, if they remember their role, if they remember their oaths, county sheriffs can save this country absent any other sort of support. You know, that county sheriff authority properly exercised can maintain order and maintain liberty regardless of whether the threat is a small street gang or a large federal gang. So there is a role for sheriff's auxiliaries, search and rescue teams, you know, public militia units that are properly run and have the right attitude. You know, and one of the things that I want to be certain to hit on is that on my blog you will see that I often say, you know, regardless of what happens, no Fort Sumters, okay? We do not engage in proactive violence, no matter how much the federal government usurps our liberties in writing. What we have to do, what our task is, what my task frankly is now primarily, is to inculcate the idea of resistance, of refusal, right? There are many ways to mess up their system by refusing it. Eventually they will become so frustrated that they will react with violence. But it is only when they attack us that we are released to repay them in kind. And, you know, people say, well, how many of us do they gotta kill? I mean, you know, how will we know when? And all I can say is, you'll know. It will become obvious that they have ceded the moral high ground. And then at that point, there are ways to get their attention.
We've only got two more minutes left. We're on with Mike Vanderbo of 60thStreetIrregulars.com.
Well, Can I go ahead and take that time then to promote the Open Carry March, which is going to happen in D.C. on the 19th, not D.C., actually. We're across the river, across the Potomac River in Virginia.
Virginia,
we'll
right?
be having an Open Carry rally, which begins at Fort Hunt Park and then goes to Gravelly Point, where we will be openly carrying loaded pistols. We will also have unloaded rifles. And the point that we are attempting to get across is that the point of the founders is that if you are unable to exercise a right, you do not have it. All right? It is illusory. It is a lie. So we are exercising our right to keep and bear arms directly across the river from, you know, the district of criminals, right? The people who would take those rights away from us.
Right.
And we expect to get their attention. We expect an orderly march. We expect a disciplined march. But it will be a march as none other in memory since the founders. And I hope that some of your listeners can go to the various links. If you want to just put in Open Carry Fort Hunt, and that should take you to wherever you want to go.
Okay. Real quick, we've got just one quick minute. I spoke with you earlier in the week, last week, and you brought up the fact about in the McDonald versus Chicago case that if the Supreme Court rules that weapons are a civil right, then civil rights cannot be taxed. Can you just speak real quickly on that?
Sure, and this is something that I don't think a whole lot of people have paid attention to. It was brought to my attention by a very skilled Second Amendment lawyer. If it is found that the right to keep and bear arms is in fact a civil right, which seems evident to us, but perhaps not to everybody else, you cannot tax a civil right. And if you cannot tax a civil right, the entire gun control scheme of the 1934 Act and the 1968 Act goes out the window. Then perhaps striking down of those acts can open up our access to arms that we had prior to 1934. And wait until you hear the screaming then.
That's interesting. Do we have anyone that's ready to challenge that you know of? Have you already spoken with people that are ready to challenge that if it does?
If they rule that there is going to be that owning firearms is in fact a civil right, there are already people that are ready to file suit to overthrow then the 34 and the 68 acts.
Very interesting. Hey, we're out of time, Mike. I really have to get you on again here within the next couple of weeks because there's like 10 things that I wanted to talk to you. I just ran out of time.
Get me before I'm arrested for sedition, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. we might even do part two next week. We'll just see how it goes, okay?
All right. Well, thank you for having me on.
I really appreciate it. Mike Van Roo from SipsyStreetIrregulars.blogspot.com. Next up, we have one of our industry partners coming on. Dylan Jennings is coming on from DPMS. He's going to talk about the Outbreak Omega shoot that they're going to have here in Minnesota coming up next month. He's going to talk about a couple of the new products that DPMS is coming out with. So we can end on a happy note tonight. We won't end on all doom and gloom. We're going to give away a couple of T-shirts. We're going to actually give away a free entry to the Outbreak Omega 3 event. And for those that haven't seen it yet, check out the website www.outbreakomega.com. There's got all the information there. We're going to get Dylan online here shortly to talk about that. It looks like a really cool event. I think you go through these different stages. They've got, like, you're killing zombies, and you've got these different, you go through, you give a ticket for your stage, you go through the stage, it tells you how much ammo you'll need. For instance, stage one is called Up Close and Personal. Your patrol encounters a lone survivor, noticeably shaken and exhausted. He informs you that he and several friends have been holding out for several weeks in a nearby farmhouse and have accumulated quite a supply of ammunition and food. Unfortunately for them, a night sentry fell asleep and allowed the damned to enter the house. The lone survivor was able to escape by leaping from a window and fleeing. The others were not as lucky. Although there are surely zombies inside, including the man's less fortunate friends, the promise of ammunition and food is too tempting to ignore. This stage is for a pistol. You use 20 to 30 rounds, and it costs one ticket or $5. So you go in, you go through the house. They're going to have targets set up in there. It's just a really, really cool event, just reading that first stage there. Dylan, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm on here.
Outstanding. It's great to have you on. I was just reading the first stage to my listeners there of the Outbreak Omega shoot. It's just a really cool event. Why don't you go ahead and give everybody an overview of it?
Of the stage or the shoot?
Of the actual event, of the whole event.
Oh, absolutely. It's it's the 24th and 25th of April. It's a two-day camping event. Basically, it's a fun shoot, and it's also a free gun show. We're going to have lots of vendors, food vendors, all sorts of gun vendors. Basically, we're going to have Remington Bushmaster, ourselves, AAC, a bunch of smaller vendors as well. It's going to be a great time. We have 13 exciting stages. There's going to be pistol, rifle, shotgun. We really bumped it up this year. The one of the stages is actually inside a house, and I went and saw it today for the first time, and it is... The guy's blood's going to get pumping on this one. It's literally a shotgun stage inside of a house, so we're pretty excited about it. After that, on the evening of Saturday, on the 24th, we're going to have a big pig roast. It's going to be, you know, enough pig and basically fixings for 600 people. And then immediately after that, D.B. Searles, it's a bar, local bar in the area, is hosting the after party. It's going to be pretty cool. They're going to do... big bus for us, hopefully. We're working on the bus to have everybody, you know, bus from the range out to DB's. They're also talking about running the bus for all the people who are getting hotels. That way you don't have to worry about getting your car. You just get on the bus, on the zombie bus, and drive it into the range on Sunday and Saturday.
Oh, that's great.
And then Sunday morning is just going to be, it's a fun day of shooting. And then it's going to be great because we got unbelievable prizes. We're going to have so many guns. You know, we got a bunch of stuff in today that didn't make it on the prize table, but there's going to be even more guns than what we have on the prize table so far. I'm just waiting on, you know, a few things. We're getting some Remington guns, Marlin guns, but we already have, I think, 3 or 4 guns available now. When it comes to the shoot, the big things I want to stress is, you know, pre-register. If you don't pre-register, you're not eligible to get the big prizes, the guns, basically. You know, plus pre-registering saves you about $5. You're going to get a bunch of tickets. It's well worth it. So, I heard you guys talking about it. What have you gone over so far?
I just barely had got started. I just read the stage up close and personal, the first stage you have there on the OmegaOutbreak.com website. I just read that to the listeners just so they could get kind of an idea of what each stage would be like and what they'd be going through. You actually have some pictures up there, too, from last year. And people can go and camp out, right?
Well, I'm working on that right now. All of the official, camper campsites are full. There's a couple of little, fields on the exterior of the range that I think we can use. I'm working that out now. I mean, that's the way I kind of, envisioned it, is to let people, you know, honestly, so, you know, the zombie apocalypse, you'd expect them to be able to camp outside. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. We just had a little bit of fuzzy there, while you were talking, but no, we definitely got the idea. We're going to give away a free membership and a couple of DPMS T-shirts. Not a free membership. We're going to give away a free entry to this event. If you want to join the contest for the free entry to this year's Outbreak Omega, go to the industry forms, go down to DPMS. I just posted the thread there. In the thread, type in DPMS Zombie Killer. You will be entered. The entries will close tonight at midnight Pacific time, and then I will do the random number drawings for the prizes. So everybody who's listening, get on board now. Go to the DPMS forum in the industry forum. You'll see the thread there, Radio Free ARFCOM Outbreak Omega 3 Free Entry Contest, and post there. The words you need to post to be properly entered into the contest are DPMS Zombie Killer. Let's go back and talk just a little bit. We've only got a couple of minutes. I wanted to talk about some of the new products that you guys have coming out this year.
Yeah. The ones we're real excited about, the biggest one is the Oracle. Last year we came out with a gun called the Sportacle, and it's, you know, it's a real low price point gun, and everybody loved it. It did really, really well, but the biggest thing was it didn't come with that A3 upper receiver. You know, people really want that, you know, Ford Assist dust cover shell deflector that you see on the military gun.
Right.
So this is the exact, you know, it's the exact gun with that offered on it. And, you know, it's still a low price point gun. We're shipping a lot of them out. Right now, bear with me just 1 second. That one's great because, you know, it's like the rest of our guns. It comes with a hard case, cleaning kit, operator's manual, sling, two magazines. You know, the gun that I was doing really well, like I said last year, was the Sportacle, which is basically the same thing, but it's got a, what's called a thicker-walled or extruded-walled upper.
Okay.
Sportacle or the Oracle this year is going for $759. Like I said, it's a low-price point
wow.
gun. You can kind of decide what you want to do, flat-top upper rail, flat-top gas block. So if you wanted to put optics on there or flip-up iron sights, it's already set up for that. And then
you also have the Prairie Panther coming out this year. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. The Prairie Panther basically is it's the answer to everybody's you know wants as far as predator hunting. It's got you know a real tough coat. We have it in mossy oak and then a desert brush. It has a trigger guard that's an extended trigger guard for guys who are shooting with gloves. Of course, a lot of times predator hunters are shooting in the winter.
Right.
It has flat top upper receiver, so it's ready for optics. It's a real lightweight barrel, something you can carry all day long. It's got a carbon fiber free flow tube, so that brings about a half pound off of the weight of the gun. So, again, super lightweight. And it's got a two-stage trigger. You know, so it's perfectly set up for the predator hunters that really get into it. So
that's great. You guys always make really top-quality products. Before I let you go, I want to make sure. I read somewhere, I believe it was actually here on AR15.com, that Remington Bushmaster will have ACRs there at the outbreak event for people to try out.
I was hoping you'd ask me about that. Well, that one's that stage, I believe, is airdrop from heaven. Basically, Bushmaster is going to have two or three ACRs out there. I'm not sure on the select fire nature of their ACRs. I'm not sure how that's going to work. Last year we had a saw, so I don't think it'll be too big of an issue. But yeah, it's going to be. We're hoping to do a zombie Nazi stage. You know, we're talking to Zombie Ammo, who makes, they make a bunch of zombie targets, one of which we're trying to get a hold of is, you know, they're zombie Nazis.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be a lot of fun.
That's really awesome. So people will get a chance to shoot an ACR then, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've already secured them. Like I said, it's going to be about two or three ACRs. We expect that stage to be really, really popular.
Okay, one last thing before I let you go. Where is this exactly? I know it's in Minnesota. What part of the state is this in?
Well, it's in St. Cloud. For those of you guys who are familiar with it, it's just off of Highway 10, just before you get into St. Cloud proper. Let's see here. If you're heading up Highway 10, there was an old Denny Hecker's right there with a giant American flag right off of 10, just shy of Division. That's where we're at.
Outstanding. It looks like it's going to be a lot of fun, Dylan. I appreciate you taking some time out, getting on the show with us, and letting everybody know about this, about the new products and about this outbreak event. I'm not going to make it this year, but I promise you this. If I'm still doing Radio Free ARFCON this time next year, I will be up there, and I will be doing this with you guys, because this looks like a whole lot of fun.
It's going to be great, and I hope to see a lot of people there. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for being on. Hey, everybody, that's all the time we have for today. It seems like every week we just run out of time faster and faster and faster. I apologize for some of the technical problems we had earlier in the show. I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. Please check out the blogs of the people that we had on, Sipsy Street Irregulars, the Border Violence Analysis. Please check those out. I want to thank Merrill, as always, for keeping the threads updated. I want to thank our super producer, Seth, who we have officially converted to a gun guy, everybody. I want everyone to know that. He was already a little bit of a gun guy, but he's now officially over into our camp. He's going to work on getting his CCW and everything. We love Seth for that. He's one of us now. On that note, I'm going to let everybody go. We're completely out of time. I just wanted to say, despite everything that's happened over the weekend, despite this health care bill, I want to say God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.